Are we good to go? All right. I'll call to order the State Environmental Commission. Today is January 22nd. It's 9 a.m. Cheryl, has the meeting been properly noticed?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. And now would you please call the roll of the commission?
Chairman Ford.
Here.
Vice Chairman King.
Here.
Commissioner Rob Derrick. Larry. Here. Sorry. Commissioner Goetz.
Here.
Here.
Commissioner Casey. Commissioner Landon? Here. Commissioner Mudd?
Here.
Commissioner Beard?
Here.
And Commissioner
Person? Here. And we have some of the office on there. That's right. Good morning. Good morning. We have a quorum? Very good. All right. Before we begin, Cheryl, could you please explain to our participants online the rules for following public participation?
Absolutely. First of all, this meeting is being recorded. The meeting recording will be posted on the SEC website shortly after the meeting is adjourned. If you're participating through Teams, please mute your microphone. You can be muted for the entire meeting unless you're speaking. If you called in, we can mute your line on our end. Those wishing to make public comment or participate remotely may do so by dialing 775-2611. And using meeting extension 1-877-000-023 pound, or raising your hand to Teams, Michael, so if you're joining via the Teams app, meeting ID is 244-965-7778, 495-62, and the passcode is W-N-64-S. Finally, if you're participating in person, please come and sign in so we have a record.
Thank you. Do we have any changes to the agenda, Cheryl?
We do. The very discussed agenda item number 5, the facility has requested to pull that agenda item and present it at the next SEC meeting.
Okay. And that was 21st Century Environmental Management, correct? Okay. So anybody that's here today or participating online, that agenda item will not be heard today. Okay, moving forward. Agenda item number 2, public comment period. This is a time for members of the public to come forward for public comment to speak on non-agendized items. If you have a comment, please come forward if you're here in person. If you're participating online, please raise your hand virtually so Cheryl can call on you. But this is the public comment period for non-agendized items. Items on the agenda will have their own separate public comment period. So. See anybody, Cheryl, online?
No hands raised online.
Okay. I'll close that public comment period. Agenda item number 2, moving on to agenda item number 3, the September 9th, 2025 approval of the minutes. Do we have any changes, corrections, or additions from the commission? Okay. Seeing none, I'll call for a motion to approve.
I'll motion to approve the minutes from the last.
Okay.
Second.
Okay. Motion's been made and seconded. Any discussion? Call for the vote. All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion carries. Minutes are approved. All right. Agenda item number 4, penalty estate assessments. Staker and Parsons Company, NOAV 3189. You have members from the division and from the company, it looks like. Welcome. We'll start with the division first. Please introduce yourself, then.
Good morning. Chairman Korda, members of the commission. My name is Andrew Tucker. I'm here for the meeting. Joining me is Michelle Grover, the supervisor of the enforcement branch. We are here to recommend a penalty for Staker and Parsons companies in the amount of $10,000. Notice of alleged violation, NOAV for short, number 3189. NOAV 3189 was issued because Staker and Parsons and not conducted source compliance testing within the time frame required by the permit. As the commission may recall, we've been discussing the possibilities of supplemental environmental projects and resolution prior to the penalty being recommended before the commission. In this case, the council is interested in expressed interest in. With that, I will turn things over to Michelle to go through the specifics of the NOAA.
Good morning, commissioners. As Andrew said, the air penalty for today's NOAA 3189 for Baker & Parsons. Baker & Parsons holds a Class 2 permit for their aggregate asphalt plant near Elko, Nevada. Their permit was last revised on September 22nd of 2025. This permit allows the facility to operate a hot mix asphalt plant, aggregate crushing operation, aggregate washing operation, and a concrete plant. NOAA 3189 is for a late test. On June 25th, 2024, client staff conducted a full on-site inspection of the facility. During this inspection, client staff discovered that there were water sprays that were not installed in multiple emission units and that the facility had failed for renewal testing on System 25, which is part of their drum mix asphalt plant and their drum dryer. The division issued a warning for the failure to install water sprays, and as warnings are not recommended to commission, we will not be addressing that further. The renewal testing for System 25 was for particulate matter less than or equal to 10 microns in diameter, PM10, particulate matter less than or equal to 2.5 microns in diameter, PM2.5, sulfur dioxide, oxides of nitrogen, carbon monoxide, volatile organic compounds, and opacity, and was due by November 22nd, 2020. The facility did not complete the required testing until July 23rd, 2024. The purpose of source testing is to directly assess the extent of air pollution and to evaluate the effectiveness of the emission control strategies. It is a real-time snapshot of exactly what the system being tested is releasing every time it runs. Class 2 sources are required to complete source testing every 5 years. I gave you each a penalty matrix walkthrough to highlight how we came to our recommendation. In the first row of the matrix, highlighted in red, find the type of violation, in this case, late test or failure to test. Then in the first column, highlighted in yellow, find the permit class, in this case, class 2. Looking at where the two meet, give the base penalty amount of $600 per system per month, up to a maximum of $10,000 per system. The facility was late to test one system and was 20 months late. Last, we look at the bottom of the table, highlighted in blue, to find the time basis, which is each test. There was one testing event missed. Additionally, the facility has had no previous violations in the last 5 years, and there are no additional mitigating factors to consider. The total recommended penalty in this case is $600 times one system times 20 months for a total of $12,000. As there is a cap of $10,000 per system for this penalty, the actual recommended penalty will be $10,000. There is a draft finding of facts and conclusions of law in the binder for your consideration. Do the commissioners have any questions?
Any questions for the division staff? Seeing none, I guess we have some representatives here from the company. We wish to speak. Please state your name.
Good morning. I'm Nate Johnston. I'm the general manager of State Parsons. Excuse me, I'm still a little congested from a cold a few weeks ago. On a side note, I came in here last night, and I was born in this valley, raised in Carson Valley, and I'd be lying if I choked up. Seeing all the traffic this morning, the one thing that has not changed with the dinner at JT's and Marie Louise last night and Shots Bakery across the street. As a GM here at Staker Parsing, I started back June 4th of 2020. My responsibility is to oversee all of our operations with the aggregate, asphalt, you know, shops, and our construction operations. Besides the commercial successes of those, we've got to make sure our people are safe. We go home in one piece every day, and we stick to our environmental requirements. We're happy to be here, besides the previous thing that I just mentioned at JT's, to address this with you guys and kind of fill in some blanks. This is my favorite environmental technician. He's been a huge help for me since I started. He started one year for me. And that's when we started finding out about a lot of these things.
Thanks, Nate. My name is Christopher Rose. I'm the environmental specialist for Staker and Parson Companies. My primary area is on the South Wasatch Front, which mainly is Utah. I serve several operating companies. Elko Construction is one of those. As I mentioned, the vast majority of my range is in Utah. Our Elko facility is the only location of ours that is located in the state of Nevada. So my job is to maintain and update all applicable environmental plans and permits, air quality operating permits, water permits of all sorts, hazardous waste, et cetera, other environmental areas as well. And I've held this position since May 6, 2024, just about a month before the start of the year.
You want to read that next part, too?
Absolutely. We'll just go through a quick walk down of the timeline as we see it. Compliance with this. So, our Elko facility completed a stack test for assessment in September 2017. This test was passed and was valid for 5 years. Next stack test was due in late 2022, but was not performed. However, the plant obtained renewal of its air quality operating permit in April 2023. So, when I took this role on in 2024, I evolved the operations at all of the sites that I inherited. And I determined that Elko's stack test hadn't been performed yet. So I reached out to the Bureau of Air Pollution Control. I started on May 6th. I reached out on May 14th about this issue and what our best route of compliance would be with this. And I've been working with Jens Christensen with the Bureau of Air Pollution Control from that date forward.
Jens, I was 2 weeks into my new role, drinking from a fire hose, and he showed up one day when I got a power outage, well house down, crusher down, asphalt plant down, and said, "Hi, I'm from NDP, and I'm here to provide your inspection." Like, great, well, Chris, I'm new, so let's walk through this together. And he said he was new, too. And he was very helpful. So that's when he brought it up that we hadn't done a stack test since 2022, and I told him that Chris was also new. Just a big player of that. He pointed out a few other things that we had to work on at the crusher, the spray nozzles at the drop points. We had some, but not all of them. I had that rectified a couple days afterwards after he left. We wanted to note that we had self-reported about this stack test not being done as soon as we found out about it. This thing is approved. I don't know why it wasn't performed. There was some confusion about volumes, and it's tough to look. The people do the stack test out 3-4 months ahead of time when we don't have asphalt projects that they scheduled out that far in advance. We're smaller operation. But that aside, we were committed to making sure that we're in compliance and stick to our obligations with those. We had that stack test performed July 23rd, less than a month after Jens made his surprise visit. That passed. It took a little bit of coordinating with projects and a very expensive company that agreed to come and do it. August 4th, we received a letter of alleged findings regarding the major findings still at issue. NDEP proposed a fine for the lake stack test and a warning related to those water spray nozzles at the crusher. We attended an enforcement conference with them regarding these matters on August 19th. And after that enforcement conference, we received the notice of alleged air quality violation October 1st, 2020, with this fine that they've just recommended. We're not appealing this. I'm going to go a little bit off script here. I hate reading this stuff. You're looking at the cleanup crew like I kind of joked about a little bit ago. I don't know why that wasn't done before. But you see, you know, I started June 4th. He was May 6th. Jens showed up June 23rd, 25th. A couple days later, we had all of those spray nozzles put in. And less than a month later, we had that stack test done. We're here to show you that we recognize the seriousness of this and our obligations and what we should be doing. I fired a lot of people this past year and a half. I've got a great team, and this guy especially that has helped me immensely with understanding all of our permitting and client stuff. I'm just going to keep moving forward with what we've got in place now because it's pretty good.
Just a few more details to add. You know, we, as Nate touched on, we do you know, typically do regular stack testing on our hop plants, you know, as required in the states of Nevada and Utah for different areas. Typically, during the busy season, it can be a very long lead time to get a stack test scheduled. Coordinating between paving crews and the stack testing company, 3-4 months is typical. I was being quoted 6 months or more by different companies, but we were able to pay a hefty premium to get a stack testing company to drop what they were doing and come test it, which is how we were able to get it tested less than 4 weeks after the recommendation was by Jens at the inspection. I also want to just note, Bureau of Air Pollution Control, we're saying our latest permit renewal was in September of 2025. We actually had another permit update in November of 2025 as well. So we've had several updates to our air quality operating permit just to make sure that everything is fine-tuned, the wording is correct. This in particular was, I believe the November update was to fix one erroneous fuel type listed on one page or something like that. You know, so we are actively updating our class two as we see.
All right, thank you. Questions from the commissioners for Mr. Rose or Mr. Johnson?
Chairman
Porter? Yes.
I just wanted to make a disclosure that I've had a previous work relation with Mr.
Okay.
I just wanted to put that on the
list. Okay.
I don't know if you think
that's my other favorite.
So I would, if you prefer, I'd abstain from the vote.
I'll leave it up to you.
Okay.
I don't see an
issue.
I don't
feel a conflict, but
yeah.
I just
okay.
wanted.
All right, very good. I'll leave it up to you whether you want to abstain or not. Very good.
And briefly, I just wanted to add, we have legal representation, Chintan Meen. He's joining virtually on Teams, and
okay.
he is our
Any other questions from the commission or Mr. Rose or Mr. Johnson?
Fred,
yeah.
Fred. This is the second time we've had a stack test come before us, well, in, I think, two meetings. Describe a stack test to me, would you?
Off of the drum dryer, the emissions that come off of that goes into a bag house. And it's a big, imagine a big giant box with these bags inside collect dust. And the air will blast it, purge it, and then it doesn't go out into the air, it drops into a trough of sorts at the bottom and collect it, recycle, reuse it, get rid of it. That stack house test is related to those emissions from that drum. When you put all the aggregate in that drum and turning it to make asphalt, all the dust that's in that drum goes into that bag house and gives you a big dust cloud.
And I'll add to that, logistically, I guess, with the stack test, we have a consultation company out come out, typically have like an on-site laboratory. We have exhaust bungs in the stack for the bag house, and we will put probes into stack regular increments. Typically, we test about 3 runs at about 90 minutes each at maximum typical production for the plant, and those will, with a variety of testing instruments, test the various parameters. Typical stack test is PM10, PM2.5. This particular plant requires a full suite of criteria. It's PM10, PM2.5, NOx, SO2, CO, and VOCs.
And that's a bunch of different chemicals.
Exactly,
right?
Yes.
So just roughly, how many tons do you got to run through it?
There was a little bit of confusion about that in the beginning, and we were able to sort that out with Jens. I think they wanted you to run 90% capacity at our 400-ton permit. But because we rarely were such a small operation, we don't have jobs that big. You know, we're not like Lockwood and some of the other large facilities down. So we were able to run at a reduced full bore tonnage, not the 90% of 400 tons an hour, but it was the plant was running fully operational for the period of the step test.
I will add as well, I conversed a little bit with Jens regarding this, and he had actually indicated in one of the was reduced to what actual typical production for the brand point is. So it was max actual production for what
in reality
for what the plant puts out.
It was a little over 200 tons an hour, 270 something.
Yeah.
And what are you permitted for?
400.
Okay.
But that's a rare case. In a year and a half I've been there, we did a big job. Another contractor there in town, it was close to 300 tons, just a little over 300 tons an hour. If somebody's got the trucking and they can stay on top of it, we can go that fast. But this little small town, it's not.
How long do you have to run the test?
The test, we do three runs of 90 minutes each. There's about a 30-minute setup in between each test. So this is part of the difficulty of scheduling the stack test is we have to have consistent maximum production for the plant for the entire operating day, which in reality is pretty tricky logistically when you're coordinating with paving.
So you'd have to run 300 tons, and then the contractor gets shut down for 90 minutes?
No, because we have silos. You can store the asphalt in the silo and keep loading trucks while they're getting set up.
But you got to have a 1,000-ton order, right?
Yeah. And hope everything goes smoothly.
Other questions from the commissioners?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Johnson or Mr. Rose, what does a stack test typically cost your operation?
This one was, I believe it was just under $25,000.
Yeah, $24,000. The other ones that they had been seeing in Utah were $12,000, $13,000.
Yeah, we, if the company is local, we can get about $8,000 to $10,000, typically $6,000 to $8,000 if it's very close to the testing company's headquarters. This one was... Again, we paid a premium to have them drop what they're doing and come out and test. And their base testing company is based in Fort Utah, so it was about a 300-mile each way, as they were the most available testing company.
Thank you.
Other questions?
If I may, Commissioner just make a comment. Sure. Tina Mudd for the record. Thank you guys for the self-reporting for showing up today. It goes a long way. Showing that you're willing to take ownership. And Fred, to kind of answer your question too, for these small plants, the issue is getting the tonnage to do the test. That's in the remote areas, it's really hard to get a 1,000-ton day. It just is. And so I think I appreciate NDP working with folks that have these smaller plants to get it done, because it is logistically a nightmare. So thank you guys for quickly trying to react and get it done. We certainly appreciate that.
Yeah.
So thank you.
I think one of the things that smaller plants struggle with is the permitted limit versus what you actually do. You purchase these plants and you have a certain capacity, and obviously you want to permit them at the max capacity in the case that you do get a job, I assume, that big. But unfortunately, in many cases, your jobs are much smaller, and so you've got this conflict to run that. And that's, you're not the only company that's come before us with that issue. There is consideration for permitting lower, but then you're held to that permit limit. Right. Right, exactly. Other questions from the commissioners? Anybody? Okay. I'll open it up to public comment on this agenda item. Anybody wishes to comment on agenda item number 4, please raise your hand virtually or come forward if you're here in person. No hands being raised. All right. Well, I will close the public comment here, period, on this agenda item and bring it back to the commission for discussion. Okay. Seeing no discussion, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to approve the fine amount of $10,000 for NOAV number 3189. Pursuant to the findings and facts and conclusions of law found in the draft order.
Very good. It's been a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second that motion.
Okay. Commissioner Mudd has seconded. Any discussion on the motion?
So, real quick, Commissioner Glayer, for the record, while looking at this and hearing from the company that was had the alleged violation, I had that thought of reducing the fine to the date that was self-reported. However, since he already reached the cap and there was a $2,000 decrease, it's actually already at that point. So, I appreciate the company self-reporting and working as fast as they did get done.
And I think the other factor here is they were issued a warning for no controls, of which there's no penalty amount for that. So, anyway. All right. Any other comments or discussion before we move for a vote? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving and upholding NOAB 3189, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion carries. And thank you for coming in to share with us the thing. All right, we do not have agenda item number 5, the variance request from 21st Century, so we'll move on to the regulatory petitions, agenda item number 6. Permanent Regulation R123-24P, Bureau of Administrative Services.
This would be changing my hat from SEC Chairman and members of the Commission. My name is Cheryl Fontaine for the record. And for this agenda item, I just removed my SEC hat, put on my SEC hat. Thank you for the opportunity to present the proposed regulations of R123-2. Next slide. Nevada's water needs are ever-changing and require as many resources as possible to use the same water resources in our area state. Two long-standing programs for water infrastructure financing in Nevada include the two USPA state revolving fund programs administered by the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection, DEP, and Nevada's Capital Improvements Grant Program administered by the Board of Financing Water Projects and staffed by NEP. These programs work in partnership and have a long history of providing affordable funding for water infrastructure projects that have improved public health, protected Nevada's environment, and secured water resources for the long-term sustainability. Many of these projects have further benefited communities that are disadvantaged when compared to other communities in the state, helping more sustainable. There are two parts to the state revolving fund program, the drinking water and the state water revolving fund for DWSRF and CWSRF, respectively. The Clean Water SRF was established in 1987 to provide financial assistance to water systems to help achieve the health protection objectives of the Clean Water Act. The Drinking Water SRF was established in 1996 for similar reasons related to the Safe Drinking Water Act. Both programs were designed to provide federal grants to states that would then loan the funds to water systems for infrastructure projects with the idea that loan repayment dollars to the state would be able to be reloaned, which would result in a sustainable source of funds for water system infrastructure projects for the state. Next slide. During the 82nd legislative session in 2023, Assembly Bill AB 20 was adopted in part to expand the list of entities eligible to receive funding for water infrastructure projects from NDPs on financial assistance or LFA. The passage of AB 20 opened the programs up to innovative projects that can do more to meet Nevada's needs and address resource deficiencies. Changes to the regulations at the federal level had resulted in Nevada statutes being more restrictive to federal laws, and AB 20 aligned NRS, Nevada Revised Statutes, or NRS, with federal law. In prior work, the Commission adopted R109-22 to update the Nevada Administrative Code, or NAC, that governed the drinking water SRF program. I will refer several times to R109-22 as I present similar proposed changes to the NACs for the drinking water SRF program through R123-2. In addition to the changes needed due to AB 20, We are proposing some additional amendments to address the following. Define affordability criteria, amend the environmental review process, amend the administrative fee for loans, align state regulations with federal changes, and some housekeeping amendments. As I mentioned, changes at the federal level over the past several decades have resulted in Nevada NRS programs being more restrictive than what is allowed in the federal level. AB 20 amended the NRS related to the Clean Water Act to align our statutes with those federal changes, paving the way for these regulation amendments today as R109-22 similarly amended the NACs for the drinking water SRF. Sections 2 through 6 of the proposed amendments in R123-24 add several definitions that significantly expand program eligibility and the type of assistance that both recipients receive. Section 18 replaces person with eligible recipient, which aligns with the expanded eligibility. And several sections change department to division and fund to account to align with changes to the NRS or prior changes to the regional resolutions. Section 21 further expands the types of assistance available for recipients to include principal forgiveness and zero interest loans. R109-22 amended the NACs, expanding eligibility for the drinking water SRF. Part of that process included redefining disadvantaged community to include the use of metrics beyond median household in determining disadvantaged status. The clean water SRF program uses eligibility criteria the same way. Rather than define those metrics in Nevada Administrative Code, which results in misalignment of federal and state requirements each time a change is made at the federal level, the SRF programs instead define those metrics in an annual intended use plan that is submitted to our federal funders annually and does go through a public participation process, which is in NAC 4458-764. These changes are to refer to the IUP intended use plan in the NACs and align the clean water and drinking water SRF programs for increased transparency and clarity for borrowers and funders. Sections 2 through 6 add relevant definitions, and Section 37 amends the requirements of the IUP to include this criteria. As a condition of receiving the federal grants, the EPA requires both clean water and drinking water SRF programs to perform a state environmental process to evaluate the potential of the impacts of all potential construction projects receiving financial assistance from the SRF programs, which is in 40 CFR sections I can provide if you need them. This takes place of the EPA applying the National Environmental Policy Act or NEPA process to each of our projects and instead places that responsibility on the states. Changes were made to NEPA in 2020 and again in 2024 to facilitate a more efficient, effective time environmental process. And although the 2024 changes were vacated in 2025, the state environmental review is still required. Until recently, the details of the environmental review process were in the NACs. R109-22 removed much of the environmental review language from the NACs and instead refers to Nevada's state environmental review process. The changes proposed in sections 24 through 36 align the clean water environmental review process with the drinking environmental review process. In addition, the proposed changes shift the responsibility for the environmental review from the division to the borrower and accelerate the review time for categorical exclusions and place the determination of whether a public or stakeholder comment is significant at the discretion of the division. Next slide. As I mentioned at the beginning, the SRF programs were originally designed to be self-sustaining. That is, states would receive federal grant dollars, loan them out to water and wastewater systems for infrastructure upgrades, and when the loans were repaid, funds become state dollars, which are then available to the region. However, Nevada's working toward that goal. However, currently, states are allowed to use a portion of each grant for administrative costs, the cost of running the program, and the percentage depends on the grants. When the federal grants are no longer available, which became a very real possibility early last year, the funds available for administrative costs will become unavailable as well. To mitigate this, R109-22 added a fee to loans for the drinking water state revolving fund program. The proposed amendments in R123-24 add similar fees for the clean water SRF program to ensure future program sustainability. Specifically, Section 47 allows for the division administrator to set a loan origination fee and an annual service fee for the clean water SRF program.
program already has a loan origination fee, but this clarifies a little bit of language in that, but the annual service fee is new. Note that the regulations also require the program to offer a hardship waiver in the event that the borrower demonstrate that the fee would cause significant financial hardship, and the regulations set the criteria for determining that hardship. These fees, similar to the drinking water SRF fees, will be used for program administration. It is also noteworthy that because the program is required to offer below market interest rates, the SRF program loans, even with the added fees, are still more affordable than a traditional loan in the institution. Next slide. This slide shows the hypothetical revenue from the annual services in blue that the program would have received loans that have been initiated in the past 6 years, assuming this fee was implemented in 2021. For what I hope are obvious reasons, we can't know what loans will be taken out moving forward, so we have no way to project that revenue. But we did go back to 6 years, the last several fiscal years, and look at what those loans would have generated in fees. So that's what this shows. We closed on one loan in FY21 for $1,175,000. The annual service fee is assuming a 0.5% annual service fee for that loan would have been $5,875. Split over the term of the loan, assuming a 30-year term, the annual fee would be over $195. Adding this to the existing loan origination fee yields about $6,100 in fee revenue FY21. We closed on one additional loan in FY22 for $20 million. The origination fee for that is $100,000. Adding that to the annual fee from the FY21 loan plus the additional annual fee of $3,333 results in $103,529 in revenue for FY22, and so on. I will You can see that at least for the first several years, the revenue generated will not cover the legislatively approved cost to administer the program, at least in this hypothetical situation. I've also included the program's legislatively approved administration budget for the same time period in March. I'm happy to go through these numbers in more detail if anyone would like to do that, but I'm going to move on to the next slide. Unless there are any, I'll stop here actually and ask if there are any questions related to that.
Any questions from the commissioners at this point? Go ahead.
The Federal Clean Water Act has been amended recently within the last 10 years or so to include programmatic changes to water SRF. Specifically, the Clean Water Act only requires projects for construction treatment works to be ranked on a priority list. As we are expanding eligibility for assistance from the program to other entities and project types, we felt it was important to clarify which projects are required to be on the priority list for clarity and transparency for borrowers and the public, which is in Section 38. We have also updated the ranking criteria to align with current practices, replacing categories 1 through 6 with classes A through C, and adding the point-based criteria, including the addition of 25 points for affordability, which is in Section 4. In addition, not all clean water SRF projects are required to follow all federal conditions, a concept the EPA refers to as equivalency, which is defined in the UCFR. The amendments in Sections 57 and 58 introduce that concept and clarify which projects must follow those federal grant conditions. Davis-Bacon Wage Act, American Iron and Steel, and Bill Blair, etc. This will allow for flexibility and reduction of the administrative burden for some borrowers. Note that this does not add any additional grant conditions. It just reduces the number of borrowers project types that must comply with. NDEP is already using the equivalency concept in the drinking water SRF program. Next slide. Finally, we've taken this opportunity to clean up outdated and or redundant language and further align water SRF regulations, increasing government efficiency. Of note, the clean water SRF regulations did not include a dispute process in the past, so we've added that to mirror the drinking water dispute process. And we clarified required contents of a facility plan, didn't add that requirement, just added the contents. And we clarified the timing of submission of a letter of intent. Finally, through this process, it came to our attention that during the hearing for R19-22, December of 2022, the commission asked for an annual update for the drinking water SRF fee. program. We have been remiss in providing that update, so I'd like to rectify that today. As you can see, I hope the drinking water SRF program did not see significant revenues from program fees over the past year, 2025, when the program received almost $300,000 in service fees. The drinking water SRF has not yet expended any of those fees, in part due to challenges at program level, but we anticipate starting to do so this year, which should free up some of the funds currently used for program administration for actual loan funds. We would be happy to provide additional annual updates for the clean water SRF program as well as the commission wishes. Thank you again for your time and consideration. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you have.
Questions from the commission for Cheryl. Yes, Tina.
Thank you. Cheryl, thank you for this. This is exciting to see the alignment with the federal regs and using the process. I've worked with a group that's been kind of exciting to see the screen. So thank you for that. I had a question about this new water service fee increase and the projects associated with it. Would this go back to projects that are already applied for, or these newer, smaller projects? What sort of projects would that fund? Could it come out in comparison with the loan amount per day?
I understand the question correctly. Use for and no retroactive existing projects.
No, just what kind of projects the fees would be used for after you cover your administrative costs.
So the fees will not be used for loans. The fees will be used to cover administrative costs. So the clean water SRF federal grants that we get, that we receive, we're allowed to use a percentage of those to cover our administrative costs. And it's, I believe, from the clean water program, it's 4%. So what we're, and we typically use those to cover salary, travel, I'm not for this one, for, but, IBC, things like that. And so we currently use federal dollars to pay for that as allowed. So what we're proposing instead is, because when those federal dollars go away, that percentage goes away, we need to make sure we've got some funds kept for us so that we can continue to manage the funds. So what we're proposing is, as soon as we build up sort of a reserve to cover those costs in the future, we would take that 4% that we're currently using in federal dollars and put that back toward loans.
Okay, thank you. I misunderstood that. Thank you.
Sorry.
No, that's not your fault. That was me.
Other questions for Cheryl?
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Jason King, for the record. Michelle, it looks like that there was a public workshop held on January 7th. Is that correct?
Correct.
Can you summarize that in terms of how many attendees, what kind of comments, et cetera?
I can. I don't think I brought the workshop minutes with me, although they are posted on the website. I don't recall how many were there. I want to say it was around 20 or 30. It lasted, I think, 11 minutes. And there was one comment at the end that clarified that loan origination, that the annual service fee is in addition to the loan origination fee instead of. And we clarified that that is the case. They're both 0.5% for the most part. There's a 0.75% for the service fee if the entity takes out a loan. You don't see that. So they're both 0.5%, but then the 0.5% for the annual service fee, it's 0.5% for the entire loan amount, but it's split over the terms of. So that was the comment. That was the only comment we received. We didn't receive any written comments.
Thank you.
Other questions from the commission? Yes.
So thank you. The question I had, Cheryl, was in the environmental assessment with the shift of moving that to the applicant responsibility, is that an allowable cover cost within the loans? Is that kind of moving that cost of environmental assessments into loan costs?
That's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I think so, but I can't say that for certain. So I can get back to you on that one.
You bet. Thank you.
Thanks.
Other questions from the commission? Seeing none, I'll open it for public comment on this agenda item. See if we have anybody online that wishes to comment on this Regulation update. No, nobody's raising their hand online. Okay. All right. Yeah. We won't make you move back and forth. So. All right. All right. Seeing that nobody's hand's been raised virtually, I'll close the public comment hearing, public comment period, that is, and bring it back to the commission for discussion. I'm happy to finally see that both the Clean Water and SRF drinking water programs are now in line with federal requirements and are consistent with each other, because a lot of these people, municipalities, they're the same people, and it'd be a nightmare for one to deal with one set of rules and regulations and have to do on the other side another set. So I'm really pleased to see that. So.
Cheryl Fontaine, for the record, if I may, the previous program manager, Jason Cooper, had a huge hand in putting these together, and he retired unexpectedly about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, and these would have come before you sooner because I had to speed up. So I just wanted to give credit where credit was due.
Okay. Well done. All right. Seeing no further discussion, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, Catherine Landreth, I move to approve proposed regulation LCB file R123-20.
Thank you, Catherine. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Seconded by Commissioner Mudd. Any discussion further? Seeing none, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Cheryl.
Thank you.
You can go back to your other chair.
I almost brought a pass just.
Okay. All right. Moving on to the next agenda item, number 7, Administrator's Briefing. Ms. Carr, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. I have friends that are going to join me this time. Jennifer Carr, for the record. This is a tradition that we've had for a very long time. Sometimes I don't feel like I have a lot to say, but I assume you would like to continue the tradition. And so I have... two topics that we wanted to chat with you about today, but I'm not actually the best person to speak on them. So first, Andrew Tucker will talk a little bit about the Clean Trucks and Buses program that was established in the 2023 legislature under Assembly Bill 184, and they've been working hard on getting that program up running, and we've got some good news on that one, so go ahead.
Andrew Tucker, for the record, the Administrator Carr. As the Commission may recall, back in November 2024, regulations were adopted to implement the Trucks and Buses Incentive Program. As mentioned, it was established under Assembly Bill 84. This program provides voucher incentives for the clean trucks and buses which have zero tailpipe emissions or for the retrofit or upfitting of those vehicles. And at the time of the hearing back before, it requested about a year, a little bit late on that, having had a meeting at the end of 2025. But so between the time since that hearing, the regulations have gone into effect. They were approved by the Legislative Commission December 19, 2024, and have been filed with the Secretary of State. As the Commission may recall, AB 184 directed a portion of the Carbon Reduction Program grant funds that are awarded to the Nevada Department of Transportation to be used to provide these incentives. And the AP has been working, the Carbon Reduction Program funds are provided to NDOT through the program that the Federal Highway Administration has. And NDP has been working with NDOT and the Federal Highway Administration to address some challenges, kind of bringing this program to fruition. But we've had some kind of re- recent major milestones. We have executed agreements basically to allow for the transfer of funds from NDOT to NDP, and the Federal Highway Administration has obligated those funds specifically for the purpose of the program and for providing those incentives. We still have some additional challenges that we'll have to work through before the program comes online. Have to do some outreach and engagement with the companies that we purchase, selling vehicles, and as well as those that may be purchasing vehicles as well. But we're making progress on getting that program up and running, and optimistic that we'll be able to get the money here in the near future. The commission has questions to answer those.
I would just add that we are thrilled that the money is actually still there, since it's carbon reduction funds. Somehow FHWA had set it aside or something. Or
just don't say it too loud.
So yeah, we thought this particular program was quite dust as far as the federal funding. We have the ability to put other types of funding into this program as well, but we, like I said, we're thrilled to be able to actually do this. As far as we're aware, we are the only state in the country that's used these funds for this program. So it's been really innovative. We have huge props to Andrew and his staff, something that they couldn't crib off of anybody else.
Yeah.
So they've worked really hard on figuring out how to make this work and create this voucher system to help create these clean trucks.
And any takers so far?
Andrew Decker, for the record, we have had people that have been contacting us interested in the program, but we're not quite at the point of being able to start soliciting applications for it. But we expect that there will be.
Expecting that to start to move in 2020, calendar 26.
Okay, good. And not just clean, you know, buses, but it's you know, probably for communities that have aging vehicles, a way to replenish those and save a little money in doing so.
The pilot program is broken down into several weight classes.
Yes.
So they could be semi-trucks, they could be like local delivery trucks, they could
gotcha.
Be buses, public buses.
Okay.
Just about over my skis here.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay. Are eligible from us to be, which is kind of the lower end, is a grocery that counts up to the largest collection.
Great. That's great. Yeah, good deal.
Any other questions on that?
Fred Reeder, how much would you fund, like, a semi truck? I mean, is there a percentage you would fund on it?
So, Andrew Tucker, for the record, it depends on the vehicle weight. Class reading, but on the top end for expect for tractor trailer and stuff like that would be up to $175,000
yeah.
per vehicle, but it is capped at the kind of incremental cost between a conventional version of that same vehicle and electric or hydrogen. Mm-hmm.
We price a semi.
Other questions for the staff here on this item? Good, keep us posted.
Thank you, Andrew. Okay, Jennifer Cargan, for the record. The next project that I wanted to present for you today as well, or update it for you, is one where there's been a bit of discussion over the last few years about updating the air penalty metrics. It's been around for a while, and you all have as well as staff struggle a little bit for things that don't fit quite right. And so I'll let Michelle talk about something she's working on in regard to your penalty matrix for the air.
Michelle Grover, for the record, global commissioners. I'm really excited to tell you some general details. This penalty matrix and rewrite is part of my capstone project for the certified public manager program that's offered by the state. So that's kind of you can think of it like an MBA for the state, but more geared towards becoming better
tackle some of the public policy challenges for the next generation. And so this is my project for that. As you know, the penalty matrix was introduced in 2008 and has not been updated since. We have run into issues over the years that still could be resolved by taking a fresh look at how we resolve these penalties. We plan to do this in two phases and looking how we come to penalty amounts. In the first phase, which is what my CTM project would encompass, we'll be examining the base penalties, the time period multipliers, and mitigating factors, how we account for those. And we plan to benchmark other states and come up with an overhaul that we will then present to facilities during public outreach before coming to you after addressing any concerns that they may have for final approval of the new system that we come up with. In the second phase, we'll be examining economic benefit and how we can more accurately and precisely assess this when coming to the penalty recommendation. But that will not be part of the CPM project. The plan is to have new penalty calculations approved by the commission around the summer meeting, hopefully, fall at the latest, and operational by the last meeting of this year. I would like the commission's input on how they would like me to communicate milestones, if any, outside of the normal meetings. Thank you for working with us on revising the way we come to penalty amounts. Do you have any questions or comments for me? Keeping in mind, I don't have much detail as of yet. The project is not officially started.
Questions for Michelle?
I don't have any questions. Oh. I just want to congratulate you, Michelle, for the Capstone Project and CPM.
Yeah,
that's
very good.
Fantastic.
Will the new penalty matrix, include some reference to the SEPs? Because sometimes when we go through these things, and now Andrew explained with this last penalty matrix or violation that we had, that the subject of SEPs was discussed at the enforcement conference, I guess, or at some point during the process before it came to us. Does the new penalty matrix have any reference to that?
Michelle Grover, for the record, we can address that and kind of look at, because part of it will be looking how the process goes. Mm-hmm. So we can address that, like when SEPs are offered or when, what path we take, we could address that.
I think so, because a lot of times when the entity shows up here, that hasn't been broached with them. And if there was a way that when you come with an agreement or, non-appeal, I guess, if that was shown through the penalty matrix or the discussions with the company, I think that would be a lot better for all of us to kind of, it'd be easier for us to get through versus you coming back after we said, no, we'd like to see a SEP, we're going to set this part of the penalty aside, and if it can be cleaned up, in that enforcement conference or sometime thereafter, before you come to us with, if they want to go the SEP route, I think that would be preference in my mind. I'll open it to the other commission members.
Absolutely. Michelle, for the record, I think that we can absolutely look at that and come to an agreement on how that should look.
Okay.
Before coming to the entity.
Great.
Please feel free to reach out and use us as test subjects when you want to test an idea or concept out.
Absolutely.
That's a good
question. The reason I got here to CPM that it's one of many things that are thrown at you at that point in time. And so there's a good opportunity to reach out if you want to say this makes sense. Happy to help with your own mission. Yeah, that's another recent graduate with Jennifer. Reach out, ask questions. And then my other question was, are you engaging the public in this matrix at all here?
Michelle Grover, for the record, yes, we plan to, once we have kind of a basic outline of what we are going to be proposing, to reach out to all the facilities in the AIR program and give them a chance to, hear what we're changing and why, and get questions and comments on the process. But if that's the best before we bring it to you for a final approval.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Tina, yeah.
Congratulations, by the way, that's exciting. What, in your opinion, what is the most critical piece of the matrix to fix? What do you guys struggle with the most on your side of the fence?
Michelle Grover for the record. So I think part of that is sometimes the penalties don't seem to match what happened, and we don't have a good way of accounting for mitigation factors currently. Like it's in the matrix, but we don't have a good way of actually like saying this is what this mitigation is for. And then also sometimes the penalty matrix can get like it's very easy on record keeping if you're on to majors for record keeping to go into the millions of dollars range. So, you know, kind of addressing some of those facts and bringing them into line with like what our actual practices are and we actually like to spread it.
Okay.
For the rating. Yeah.
Other questions from the commissioners? Well, let us know when you complete your program. We would like an update when you've successfully gone through it. Congratulations again. All right.
Right. Thank you, Jennifer, for the record. So I would observe that we came to the same conclusion about the process of incorporating SEPs into air penalties.
Okay.
After a couple of meetings. Most recently, what was it, the DMI? Was the name? And before that, some of you are very familiar with some steps that we've negotiated recently, but the first time that it was proposed and the company didn't really know what you were talking about, but they're like, uh-huh, sure. I followed them out to the hallway and explained what it was that just happened.
Yeah.
And then with DMI, the same thing happened.
Yeah.
And Danilo and I were in the lobby. Yeah. We chased them out.
Yeah.
And we're like, okay, this is what this was just all about. So we're like, okay, yeah, we need a better way. And that is why you saw what you did today in regard to trying to change up the process to inform these folks about this as an option you know, before it comes to you. So they're not just deer in the headlights trying to figure out what this opportunity might be. Like in the case of DMI, they oh, that sounds like a great idea. But then when it came down to it, they didn't have their own internal resources or whatnot to actually do a set type project. So we are working on streamlining that, but incorporating it into a formal process for you know, for transparency and perpetuity, I think is a fantastic solution.
Right. And just a comment that, you know, I mean, the penalty is one thing, but if it can go to something to benefit the community in which they're at, I think everybody on this board agrees that that's a better way to go. So anyway, if we can get incorporated early and cleaned up before you come to us with the violation, that would be great.
Yeah, the steps hadn't been used in a long time.
Yeah.
And folks sort of resurrected them, and because that is the desire of the commission. Even though you don't see other penalties, we've been talking about them in more of the water programs and other areas where also enforcement and fines as well, because clearly it's the desire of the commission. So even though you don't see those, they are finalizing, and we are the theme of that has been resurrected. Pervasive.
Is there anything in the regulation that would prohibit it, the introducing the SEP early in the process? Like, does it have to come to the commission before it can be proposed? So there wouldn't be a barrier in that sense. Okay.
No.
Good.
No.
I was just thinking, I was like, that's awful. Okay, thank you.
Matter of fact, I don't think there's anything in the regulation about a SEP, is there?
No, there's
yeah, so it's division policy more than anything. Sorry.
Jennifer Carpenter, it's actually based in federal EPA policy,
where
we have basically carried that into our process, but you're right, it is not in regulation. It's essentially an out-of-court settlement, and so we have the enforcement discretion to go down that path, but we use EPA's effective.
And just for clarification, the other bureaus, they have to negotiate their penalties through the court system or legal basis, mostly, right? Versus the air programs specific in the regulation, they have to have their fines approved by the commission.
Yes. Jennifer Carr, for the record, in the event that we can't negotiate an out-of-court settlement between ourselves and the company, which we do most of the time, if we are pressed to finalize that action, it would be a district court again.
Yeah.
In those cases, we then go to court with the maximum
potential
penalty, which, you know, the numbers are in the millions, and then they negotiate.
Yeah. So just so the other commissioners know, that's why we don't have water, people with water violations coming before us and stuff, hazardous waste. So, all right, very good. Anything else?
The only other thing I had today is it's bittersweet news. I wanted to let you know that Andrea Seifert, who has been bureau chief for the drinking water program for a number of years now, probably at least 13 years, and worked in as a supervisor before that. She was in the drinking water program when it resided at the health division before it came to MVP in 2005. And before that, she did a little bit of work in Division Water Resources at the time. She is retiring at the end of next week.
Oh, wow.
That she's leaving very, very big shoes to fill. Danilo is in charge of the recruitment. There are some excellent candidates on the list, and that effort will progress in February. I just wanted to let you know that Andrea has spent a solid 30 years here, and we are very proud of the work that she's done, her effectiveness with the regulated community and everything that we're drinking. I want to let you know that we are having lunch with her today. This 21st century is no longer on the agenda. I'm sure I can make that lunch. It's the end of an era to some degree. Speaking of 21st century EMI, this is my binder that I had before they pulled themselves from the agenda. So just so you're, aware, this section is some homework that you're going to see for the next go round. I just want to give you.
I've been reading it several nights. I've been reading the 300 roughly page application and argument for the variance. Yeah.
Our staff had a meeting with them recently about our view of the request and how we would be presenting it to the commission, and they said, hang on a minute, let us go back.
Okay.
We expect that we will we'll be working with them again here soon in that field.
Very good. Any other questions for Jennifer?
I don't have a question. I just have a comment.
Sure.
Jennifer, you said sometimes you feel like you don't have much agree. The amount of different industries, communities, and things you guys have impacts on is amazing, and how much work you guys do. So any update is appreciated. What you guys do, we really appreciate all the work that you've done.
And give Andrea my best. I remember meeting with her group at the health division when they were told they were moving to NDP, and there were a lot of nervous folks in that room, and Andrea was instrumental in making the transition to DEP, and has done a great job since she's been here. So wish her my best.
I will.
All right. Any other questions for Jennifer? All right, seeing none, move on to agenda item number 8, the final comment period. Anybody, member of the public wishing to comment on today's hearing, please raise your hand. I don't think there's anybody here in the room. Cheryl's looking online right now. No hands raised. So I'll close the public comment period, agenda item number 8, and move to agenda item number 9. Unless anybody has any objection, we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting. All right. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you, everybody.